Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In podcast number 84. My name's Terry Frost, and this time around, it's Mars all the way. For a start, I'm going to look at the classic 1964 science fiction movie, Robinson Crusoe on Mars, starring Paul Mantey, Vic London, and Adam West. And from there, we go to 2015 for another movie about a man marooned on Mars, and that is The Martian, directed by Ridley Scott and starring Matt Damon. So it is Red Planet City this time around. Sit back, I'm going to get the contact details out of the way, and we'll get started on the trip to Mars. The Martian Drive-In podcast appears every 2 weeks. It's a podcast of science fiction, horror, and fantasy movie appreciation, and sometimes television. It doesn't matter if it's old or new, good or bad, black or white or colour. As long as I like it, it may show up here. There are also occasional roundtables where I get together a group of like-minded people and we discuss a particular topic of interest to genre film nerds. You can support the podcast by donating at patreon.com/paleocinema. You can keep up with podcast news at the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can leave reviews on iTunes and send MP3 or written feedback to cultguru@gmail.com. That's cult with a K. This podcast may contain adult discussion, so don't listen to it in the car while driving the kids to school. Hi, how's everybody doing? I'm recording this one back-to-back with the last Paleo Cinema podcast because I'm going to be away next weekend in Sydney, hanging out with the family and having a great time with Sal. We're driving up there, which is about a little under 900 kilometres, so it should take us about 12 hours, really. And, yeah, it's going to be good. I'm going to chill out, catch up with the family, catch up with my six-year-old nephew, who is manic, and just, yeah, do the usual fun stuff. So there's no what I've been watching kind of stuff to do this time around. So instead I'm going to play Sally's favourite Martian song at the start of the podcast. So without any further fuss, here it is. The Randells with The Martian Hop.
Space. The Martians plan to throw a dance for all the human race.
I thought that'd get you in the mood. On to Robinson Crusoe on Mars. It's a 1964 American science fiction movie, based, of course, on Daniel Defoe's Robinson Crusoe, directed by Byron Haskins, starring Paul Mantey, Vic Dr. London, Adam West, and Barney the Woolly Monkey, who we can't forget at all. Byron Haskin, we'll talk about Byron Haskin for a little bit. I'll give you the pricey of the movie before I do that. And the one from IMDb is probably the simplest and the best one. Stranded on Mars with only a monkey as a companion, an astronaut must figure out how to find oxygen, water, and food on the lifeless planet. So there it is. Now, back to Byron Haskin. I was actually doing a little bit of research on Haskin, and quite an interesting career. He started out as a special effects guy and did special photographic effects as far back as silent movie times. He did the special photographic effects in 1925 for a movie called Clothes Make the Pirate. And he did special photographic effects on the 1935 A Midsummer Night's Dream. That was the one with Mickey Rooney playing Puck. And I believe Victor Jury played Oberon. So he had a background in special effects work, but then went on to become quite a good genre director. Amongst other things, he directed a whole bunch of movies in the silent era as well. He's got 4 credits from 1927 and then skips on to action in the North Atlantic in 1943. The movies that I most know him for are things like War of the Worlds, the one he did with George Pal in 1953, His Majesty O'Keefe with Burt Lancaster on the Island of Yap, The Naked Jungle, which is the one with the ants and Charlton Heston and Eleanor Parker. Let's see, he did Long John Silver, did a whole bunch of TV stuff, including World of Giants in 1959, a number of episodes of The Outer Limits around the same time as he did Robinson Crusoe on Mars. He did a really weird German-produced Arabian Nights film called Captain Sinbad, which starred Guy Williams and has some really interesting special effects work in it. And the second last thing he did was a movie in 1968, which I've talked about on the podcast before, The Power, which has George Hamilton and Michael Rennie in it. He died in 1984 and was something of a pioneer in special effects work in genre cinema. And all credit to him for that. Now, when you're comparing Robinson Crusoe on Mars with The Martian, there's at least one thing to consider, and that is about 50 years separates them. And 50 years is a very long time in the history of cinema. It's about 40% of the history of cinema happened between Robinson Crusoe on Mars and The Martian. If you have a think about it, what was in cinema 50 years before Robinson Crusoe on Mars? And we're talking about 1914, so you've got silent comedies, not very sophisticated things. D.W. Griffith was just experimenting with a lot of the techniques that we know from modern cinema. Close-ups, cross-cutting, all that kind of stuff was in its infancy in 1914, 50 years before Robinson Crusoe on Mars. And we're as far from that movie as that movie is from Birth of a Nation. So when you're comparing the two movies, you've got to take that 50-year gap into consideration, and the way the world has perceived genre cinema has changed enormously in that time. Now, Robinson Crusoe on Mars came out before the Apollo program. The Gemini program was just getting started. The Mercury program had been happening. Alan Shepard had orbited the Earth. Yuri Gagarin, the Russian, had orbited the Earth. Valentina Tereshova, another Russian, first woman in space, had orbited the Earth. But it was very early in the kind of space age that this movie came out. And you've got to take that into consideration when you look at the film. It gets some of the science wrong, but it tries to get some of... We didn't know a lot about the surface of Mars. The only things we knew about it were things that we could see in telescopes. We hadn't sent any probes near Mars. The first Martian orbiters and landers and things like that didn't really happen until the mid-1970s. There was one Russian attempt to send a space probe to Mars, and it shot right past it in about 1962. But apart from that, all you could know is what you could see in a telescope. So we'll take that into consideration too. And taking all those things into consideration, it's not a bad little action film. Now, Paul Manti, an ex-footballer, by the way, turned actor, isn't the best actor in the world. I mean, if you have a look at the previous Robinson Crusoe movies. You've got the Louis Buñuel one with Dan O'Hurley, which is probably the definitive Robinson Crusoe movie from the early 1950s. And if you haven't seen that, definitely do. It's worth doing. You've got silly stuff like a Disney movie from 1966 called Lieutenant Robin Crusoe, USN, which starred Pinus Van Lesbian, otherwise known as Dick Van Dyke. And it's a piece of shit, really. It's got Dick Van Dyke playing an American naval pilot trapped on an island. Instead of Friday, you have Nancy Kwan playing Wednesday. And you have Akim Tamarov in there for some reason. I saw this when I was a kid. And even in those days, I wasn't impressed with it. One of the things they inflicted on me when I was going to 12 noon Saturday matinees at the Regal Cinema in Liverpool was a whole bunch of really bad live-action Disney movies. They were really, really shit, and they were really... There were things about them that pissed me off. There's one called Follow Me, Boys, which I hate for very personal reasons. So, yeah, Paul Mantee did a pretty good job given the circumstances. I think he was taken to the limits of his skills at the time. And he's a kind of likable... Robinson Crusoe character. In fact, the character's name isn't Robinson Crusoe in the movie. It's Lieutenant Kit Draper, and he's kind of, you know, resourceful, nice guy. A lot, and he kind of goes in a Gemini-style mission to Mars with his co-pilot and boss, Colonel Dan McCready, played by Adam West. They go to Mars in some very cramped circumstances. It's almost like they've got about as much space as an average sedan. Plus, they're sharing a fairly limited life support system with a woolly monkey called Mona, who's actually played by a male monkey for reasons best known to monkey handlers. Now, come to think of it, this is one of the problems I had with the movie Alien as well. You don't want to share a closed life support system with a cat. And you don't want to share a fairly small spaceship with a monkey. But we'll let them go for this time. Maybe they've got special monkey toilet facilities on this very cramped little spaceship that orbits Mars. Now, they have to dodge an enormous meteor. It's one of those kind of 1950s, 1960s meteors that even when they're in space where there is no air, it's still glowing and kind of hot. So they kind of dive underneath the path of this meteor and in doing so lose control of the spacecraft, and the two parts of the spacecraft separate, one with Adam West's character in it, one with Paul Mantee's character, Kit Draper, and they crash land on Mars. Draper survives and he soon finds out that McCready, his CO, doesn't. So he's got to survive on Mars. Now, the Mars that they have in this movie has... kind of, yeah, they do take some nods towards real science in the fact that the air's pretty thin. We'll kind of say, you know, Himalaya thin. So Draper, while he can breathe the air on Mars, needs to top it up with oxygen, kind of the way that mountain climbers do when they do Everest. So he's got to do things like create an alarm system to wake himself up every hour so he can change air supply. And he's got a limited supply of food, he's got a limited supply of water, and he holes up in a cave with the remaining equipment that he's got. Dodgy situation. He doesn't know where he's going to get oxygen from, he doesn't know where he's going to get food or water from. He's in exactly the same situation as Mark Watney is in The Martian, but I'll talk about that when I talk about The Martian. Draper's solutions to the problems are a little different than Watney's. The monkey, Mona, doesn't seem to want to eat or drink, and he doesn't know why until he falls through a thin crust of dirt and finds that on a level down below his cave, there's a water supply plus some kind of water plants which have edible tubers in them. Now, they actually did the tubers by putting pepperoni sticks inside the plastic casings, and then he eats the pepperoni sticks. But one way or the other, he's got food, he's got some water, he has shelter eventually, and a couple of things happen that kind of change his comfortable circumstances. And he's also got a communication unit which plays videotapes. It's kind of like a smaller suitcase. It plays videotapes. It has a radar thing on it. He tries to control the orbiter and can't get through to it, and then, according to orders, makes itself destruct. So Draper starts to get lonely and starts to hallucinate things, and then a few things happen. First off, some very strange spaceships, which kind of resemble the ones that George Pell had in War of the Worlds, start moving overhead really fast and erratically, and start blasting away at the rock around his shelter. Now, these spaceships are from a solar system in the constellation of Orion, and Draper soon finds himself with one of the escaped slaves from those spaceships, and he names him Friday. And this is a guy played by Vic London, tall, charismatic actor with a great speaking voice. He did a lot of voiceover work, and Vic London is actually really good in this film. I like the fact that he communicates non-verbally for a lot of the time. He can speak, but most of the communications are non-verbal, and Vic London does a lot with body language and facial expressions in this movie. It really is a credit to him and to the makers of the film, the way it goes. It's more than it needs to be for this kind of film. Now, I like him in this. In fact, I like him better than I like Mantis Draper, because he's got hidden depths. At one stage, Draper finds out that Friday is actually 83 years old and that his people live longer than humans. And he also finds out that he has a pill which helps them handle the low oxygen environment of Mars, and which is the reason why he doesn't need a rebreather and Draper does. Things, little bits and pieces like that, show the makers of the film are trying to address some issues. One of the things that Draper does find is that there's a kind of rock on Mars which, when heated or maybe burnt, produces oxygen, which is the opposite of what happens when things burn. And from the way it's portrayed in the film, what I think is happening, and I could be wrong on this, is that when the rocks are heated but not burnt, they do burn, but when they're heated, they release oxygen into the atmosphere, which Draper then uses to help his oxygen supply. It's a kind of, scientifically it doesn't work. If you heat things up and burn them, oxygen gets taken out of the air rather than put into it. But we'll let them have this conceit. It's one of those things that they did in these sorts of movies to make them interesting and to put in a bit of a wow factor. So we'll let that pass in this case. There's also the problem of the meteor, which was overhead, drops a whole bunch of black ash over the landscape. And at one stage, there's an ash fall which almost buries Draper and Friday, which is done quite interestingly. They used tiny little bits of black polypropylene plastic and stuck it to the bodies of the actors with honey, of all things, to make it stick. So, they were kind of doing a pretty good job trying to show that Mars is a different and harsh environment within the limitations of the technology of the time. They did a lot of location shooting in Death Valley and around Zabriskie Point. Now, I think it's in California, and Zabriskie Point, as you know, is also the name of an Antonioni movie. But the landscape kind of works for Mars. There's that usual middle of the 20th century disconnect between location shooting and studio shooting, which is common with a lot of things. If you look at the old series Star Trek, they have the same thing where they cut from doing an outdoor scene around Vasquez Rocks or somewhere like that in California, and then cut to the studio scene at Desilu Studios. And the two don't match up very well. But this is before we had the CG technologies where you could blend the light levels and all sorts of things like that and make indoors appear outdoors when it isn't really to a very high level of accuracy. It's kind of a conceit that you let pass, and people kind of accepted that at the time. People weren't as involved in the technique of movie making and television making as they are now. They watched more passively than we do in a lot of ways. And so they didn't need to know what a green screen was. They didn't need to know what reprojection was. Nothing like that, unless you were really interested. It was a little hard to get the information about this too. You've got to remember, this is the days before information technologies as we know them now. So people kind of just accepted that, in the same way that people, when cinema was first started, were startled when a train came towards them on the screen. Where, you know, our ability to kind of digest and integrate the things we see on a movie screen is something that's evolved over time, and the manner in which we process visual and auditory information from a cinema screen or even just a TV screen has changed over that time. We accepted things as real that look hokey these days because that's what was put before us. And if we think that that's something that isn't going to happen in the future, in the future the special effects of today will look a bit manky and hokey, even though they're photorealistic now. Audiences of the future are going to perceive the movies of, say, 2016 differently than we do. And they're going to see things as flaws that we accept in them. And even when we're not consciously aware of some of the CG moments in, say, a superhero movie, in the future people are going to see the little tricks and the cheats that movie makers now use to put that across differently than we see them now. And that's one of the interesting things about looking at these old films, seeing stuff that wowed audiences half a century ago and kind of learning that the reason why people were so impressed with things that we aren't impressed with now. And that's kind of cool. People were shocked by things that we're not shocked by now. People were delighted and found funny things that we find racist and sexist and homophobic now. Human culture changes, and looking at a movie like Robinson Crusoe on Mars, you can see the start of the process that led to The Martian. Now, this received a Criterion release recently, and rightly so. It's an important piece of genre cinema for the fact that it's that chew like buggery thing again. Bite off more than you can chew and chew like buggery. And that's exactly what Haskin and the makers of this film did. It's a good, honest adventure film. When I first saw it as a kid, I was blown away by it. I was really impressed with it. I wanted to be there with the monkey in the cave, using the futuristic technology of the transceiver that Draper has. I wanted to hang out with Friday. I wanted to see the spaceships. I wanted to go to Mars, and I thought that would be a very groovy thing. And of course, they don't, like with a lot of other movies, they don't have the ability to make the gravity one third of what it is. So Mars in this movie has the same gravity as Earth, but showing changes in gravity is still a very difficult thing in cinema. They do a little bit of it in The Martian. They do it in a TV series called The Expanse, but it does take some effort. And changing such a what we perceive here on Earth as a physical constant, the force of gravity at 1G, changing that for a cinema film or a TV series is still a non-trivial thing. I'm sure there'll be a way to do it in the future. The people making movies have wonderful technologies, and they're going to find a way to fake lower and higher gravity in movies a lot better than they do now. I'm actually looking forward to that. Now, the big media that's orbiting around Mars eventually crashes into Mars and starts melting the polar ice caps and causes lava flows and things like that. We now know that Mars is geologically a lot more dead than Earth is. And we know that that kind of thing is not really likely. But it plays well to the audiences at the time. And it does show the best thing about this film, and the thing that I appreciate most about it, is it's showing us an alien world. It's showing us a world that's strange and different and has its own rules as well. And all credit to Byron Haskin and the movie makers for that, because showing a world, their Mars is so very different from our Earth, and not just, you know, it's not just a faked up place with a few craters thrown around. And you know, filmed in a desert. It really does have a life of its own. The special effects, as I said, are half a century old, so we can allow the fact that they're not as good as the special effects we have now. They do have one thing that annoys me in movies of a certain era, and that is the evocation of deity. I'm not really fond of people talking about God in science fiction movies, unless the movie is specifically about the future of religion. And there's room for that as well. But in this film, as indeed in a lot of other genre films of the time and of the decade or two before this movie came out, there's talk about God, and Friday and Draper have a conversation about the nature of the deity in it. Now, we can kind of let this pass because there's a lot of religious shit in the original Daniel Defoe book of Robinson Crusoe, and Robinson Crusoe in the original book is a person of faith, so there's probably a bit of a nod to that in this particular adaptation, though this is addressed more in another adaptation, a movie called Man Friday, which Peter O'Toole was in about a decade after this film came out. And the changes between 1966 and 1976 in cinema are mind-boggling. If you want to take a look at a movie from, say, we'll say 1965 and a movie from 1975, they are vastly different in the culture that produce them and the way they're approaching certain things. I mean, there's absolutely nothing about sanitation in this movie, for instance, because that was the kind of stuff you didn't talk about. Whereas if a movie was made in 1976 or even 1972, something like Silent Running, there's at least an acknowledgement of the fact that people shit in space, and we can probably thank Stanley Kubrick for that in 2001, a movie I don't have a lot of time for, but at least it does have a toilet in space in it. But just to kind of wind up on Robinson Crusoe in Mars, it's a part of a continuum of science fiction movies. In the same way that Forbidden Planet is an adaptation of Shakespeare in a science fictional setting, this is an adaptation of another classic work in Daniel Defoe's Robinson Crusoe in a science fiction setting, and I think it works. I think that we go along for the journey willingly in seeing this film. We go along with Draper's struggles, his loneliness, he at times the verging on madness. There is a scene where he's almost mad, and that kind of loneliness and alienation, but that ability to adapt and to create and to survive. That's an important thing in both of the movies I'm going to talk about in this podcast. That adaptability and that ability to not give up and to persist and to abide. They're very important human traits. And these movies, in their own way, and with that half a century of difference between them, both of them address. And it's great that the Criterion Edition is out. I think bringing Robinson Crusoe on Mars to a new audience is a worthwhile thing to do. And Criterion, while it does a lot of things really well, is a little bit light on genre films. And I think that this particular release brought the movie back to my attention, which is not a bad thing in itself, and let me evaluate it after having seen The Martian, which people recommended to me well before I saw it on Blu-ray. And in return, I recommended Robinson Crusoe on Mars to them because the story is essentially the same, but with a half a century of difference and a half a century of increased knowledge about Mars. From the point that movie Robinson Crusoe on Mars was made till now, we have learnt immense amounts about Mars, a planet whose surface area is the same as Earth if you take away the oceans. It's a varied place, it's a magical place, it's a more hostile place to human life than we thought it was, even though we knew the atmosphere was crazy thin and didn't have the gases we needed in it, even though the gravity is lighter, it's hard to get to and it's hard to get back from, all of those kind of issues. The perchlorates in the Martian soil are dangerous to human life in that they can cause thyroid problems. So some of the salts in the dirt on Mars are dangerous to human life. And if we ever settle there or even visit there, that's something that we'll need to address. It doesn't get addressed in either of these movies. It's just something that I know because I'm a bit of a science wonk at times. But leaving all of that aside, I like this film a lot. Not just for nostalgic reasons. I think time has allowed me to put it into a continuum of science fiction movies about space travel. And it doesn't in any way diminish the film to put it into that kind of a structure. It's a great film. It's a great adventure. You can watch it with kids and kids will love it. You can watch it with adults and they'll be nostalgic about it if they were alive when it came out, or they'll be kind of mocking of it if they weren't in some cases, or they'll just appreciate the fact that it was an attempt to tell the kinds of stories that in 2015 Ridley Scott did with The Martian. So I'm going to take a break now. When I get back, I'm actually going to talk about The Martian more than I have already.
I guarantee you that at some point, everything's gonna go south on you.
Ready?
And you're gonna say, this is it.
Watch out! Ready!
This is how I end.
Commander, Mark is dead.
We have to go now!
Now you can either accept that, or you can get to work.
This will come as quite a shock to my crewmates. And to NASA. And to the entire world. But I'm still alive. Surprise. Here's the rub. It's gonna be 4 years for another mission to reach me. And I'm in a hat designed to last 31 days. So I gotta make water and grow food on a planet where nothing grows.
But if I can't figure out a way to make contact with NASA, none of this matters anyway.
We've got an incoming message.
Mein Gott.
Mark Watney is still alive.
In your face, Neil Armstrong.
There must be some kind of way out of here.
Okay, so let's do the math. I have enough food to last for 50 days.
He's going to starve to death long before we can help.
So I'm going to have to science the shit out of this.
He's 50 million miles away from home. He's totally alone. What the hell is he thinking right now?
I am the greatest botanist on this planet.
I know how to save Mark Watney.
But we need the Hermes crew.
We either have a high chance of killing one or a low chance of killing six.
I'm not risking their lives.
It's bigger than one person.
No. It's not.
NASA rejected the mission.
So if we do this?
We're talking mutiny. If anything goes wrong, we die.
Do you realize how crazy this is?
We have no other option.
No matter what happens, tell the world, tell my family, that I never stop fighting to make it home.
Okay, The Martian is a 2015 science fiction film directed by Ridley Scott, screenplay by Drew Goddard, based on The Martian by Andy Weir, starring Matt Damon, Jessica Chastain, Kristen Wiig, Jeff Daniels, Michael Pena, Kate Mara, Sean Bean, Sebastian Stan, Axel Henny, and Chiwetel Ejiofor. And I said all of those without stumbling. Basically, the premise is pretty simple and not entirely dissimilar to Robinson Crusoe on Mars. The crew of the RS-3 manned mission to Mars is exploring the Acidalia Planitia on the 18th day of their 31-day expedition. An unexpectedly strong dust storm threatens to topple the Mars ascent vehicle, forcing them to make a hasty retreat from the planet. During the evacuation, astronaut Mark Watney is struck by debris and lost in the storm. The last telemetry from his suit indicates no sign of civil life. With the remaining crew in peril, mission commander Melissa Gilbert, Jessica Chastain, gives the order to launch to return their orbiting vessel Hermes. Return to their orbiting vessel Hermes without him. Watney awakens after the storm with the low oxygen warning and makes his way to the HAB, the crew's base of operations. He removes a piece of antenna from his torso and the suit's biomonitor, which caused the erroneous life-side readings, and begins a video diary. He realizes that his only chance of rescue is the arrival of the RS-4 crew at the Schiaparelli crater 3,200 kilometers away in 4 years. Calculating that he has enough food to only last 309 days, Watney, a botanist, improvises a farm with Martian soil fertilized with human waste, water produced by extracting hydrogen from leftover hydrazine rocket fuel, and potatoes saved for a Thanksgiving meal. He begins to modify the only functional rover to make the long journey across Mars. And that's pretty much it. It is Robinson Crusoe on Mars for the 21st century, with 50 years of increased knowledge of Mars, its environment, its perils, and its risks, and also with the assistance of NASA. Now, this movie is pretty much an antidote to irrationality, and it's one of the things I like about it. I love movies that have adventure aspects, and this is very much an adventure film in a lot of ways. I like films that have an adventure kind of side to them, where the hero thinks his way through a problem rather than punches his way through a problem. I think that's more realistic. I think it's a longer-term strategy, and I think it works. And this movie kind of has that in spades. Andy Weir's original novel was published in a very odd way. It was originally published on a blog, chapter by chapter. It then became an ebook when people asked Andy Weir to make it into an ebook. And so he made it into an ebook and sold several hundred thousand copies of it. And then a publisher took it up and wanted to do print editions. And so he kind of reversed the usual process of writing a novel. And Weir had written kind of very particular requirements of this novel, in that he didn't want his character to be depressed and down. He wanted him to be a rational person who thinks his way through his problems and who uses his mind and his knowledge and his resources to survive in the most hostile conditions imaginable. And that's what the movie does. Now, I'm not a big fan of Ridley Scott's movies. I think he's fails much, much more than he succeeds. If you've seen his Exodus movie or his Robin Hood movie, you'll know what I mean by that. On a percentage basis, he doesn't score highly. I mean, yes, his highs are pretty big, and this was the 10th most successful movie in 2015, so he did pretty well with this one. But he takes a shotgun approach to career success, and Mr. Scott's now in his 70s, so I'm not sure how many more years of productive work he has in him. But I think his oeuvre shows that his judgment's not always good when he chooses material, but in this case, he's chosen particularly well. We've got Matt Damon playing Mark Watney, and Damon is an underrated actor because he tends to play everyman sorts of roles, and he's got an everyman mug. But in this one, he is excellent. He's on the screen for a lot of the time. He's by himself for a lot of the time on screen, and he has to hold our attention and maintain that believability as a man marooned on Mars for well over a year. He does a superb job at it. The believability is absolutely there. The believability of the Martian environment is also there in a lot of ways. They filmed some of it, and they digitally imposed a place in Jordan called the Wadi Rum, which is the place where everybody pretty much goes to if they want to do a Martian landscape. It's the closest accessible analogue we have to a Martian landscape. Of course, it's been enhanced with CG for the movie, but it creates a world that anchors the story really well. The isolation is there, the vast size of it. I think the horizons are a little far away, but that's probably to play to the audience. If they had have done a genuine Mars with the close-up horizons, the horizons on Mars are closer than they are on Earth because Mars is a smaller planet, and the curvature means the horizon is that much closer. But it kind of works. It's got some of the sweep and scale. There are moments of the aerial shots of the Martian landscape in this film that reminded me a little bit of John Carter without the thotes and without the flying pretty cars. But it kind of has it there. It's got those beautiful ochre tones to it. It's a beautiful evocation of an alien world without life on it. It's easy to do an alien world with life on it. Even James Cameron could do that. But the Mars in The Martian is one of the characters, and it's a cliche to say that, but effectively it is. It's a beautiful place, but as dangerous as anywhere human beings have ever been. Now, the ensemble cast, apart from Matt Damon's Mark Watney, is pretty damn good as well. They put money at it in just the right places. Jessica Chastain's very good as the captain of the RS-3 mission, and she goes through her own problems when she discovers she's left someone behind. And it's ultimately was her decision and her responsibility to do so. She's got that to deal with. You've got Michael Peña playing one of the astronauts on there. Michael Peña is becoming the actor who steals every scene he's in. If you have a look at Ant-Man, he's fantastic in Ant-Man. In this movie, he is as well. He can do comedy, he can do drama. And in this one, he gets to do a bit of both, which is kind of cool. Kate Mara is another one of the astronauts. She's a system operator on there. Sebastian Stan, who we also know as the Winter Soldier, is Chris Beck, another astronaut on there. They have Axel Henny as Alex Vogel, a German navigator and chemist. And then on Earth, you've got a lot of other really fine character actors. Chiwetel Ejiofor playing Vincent Kapoor, the mission director. Sean Bean in a very different Sean Bean role. I like Sean Bean in this movie. He doesn't die. Gets a sack, but he doesn't die. As Mitch Henderson, who's the one of the other mission directors. And he makes a moral decision that saves the day, but ultimately costs him a certain price, which is kind of cool. And seeing Sean Bean not being an angry psychopath is a beautiful, reassuring thing in this film. We've got Jeff Daniels in there as Teddy Sanders, the NASA administrator. Jeff Daniels, of course, plays the kind of male patriarch kind of character really well, but in this one, his character of Teddy Sanders is flawed. He doesn't want to take any risks, and he's very aware of public perception and things like that, and actually, he is one of the anchors that stops things from getting fixed sooner than they are. Then you've got Donald Glover playing the guy who thinks up one of the ways they plan to go back to Mars to pick up Watney, which is kind of cool. And Benedict Wong is really good as Bruce Ung, the director of JPL. And he gets some great moments in there. And then you've got Kristen Wiig playing the director of media relations for NASA, Annie Montrose. And she gets her own moments too. It's nice to see her career straddling both comedy and serious work. And in this one, her character definitely does that. NASA, as I said, had a lot to do with this movie. It tried to help them get the science right within certain parameters. There's no mention of that permanganate problem that I mentioned, where people's thyroids can be affected by the subtle poisoning you get from having those kind of salts in the environment. But that's only a fairly recent discovery, and they could well have been in pre-production at the time that came about, that was discovered that happened. I've also got, the only other problem I've got with the science of it is I'm not too sure about the, that at one stage the seal on the habitat blows and Watney has to fix it, and his method of fixing it without doing any spoilers is something that I'm not sure it would necessarily work. But I could be wrong. I'm wrong about many things. I could be wrong about this one. But having that that big thing that he uses sealing it seems to me to be just looking for trouble. But on the other hand, this story is partly about the science, but it's also about human ingenuity, people's ability to solve problems on a massive scale with very little resources, as long as they can overcome their own fear. And one of the great things about this movie is, even though there are character flaws in all of the characters, I like it when astronauts are shown to be people who can manage anything that comes up, because you don't send people in multi-billion dollar missions who are going to fall apart. The psychological and physical testing required to be anywhere near a spacesuit is monumental. You've got to have the kind of personality that sees opportunities in challenges, who can kind of think their way out of something that other people will be in a crying heap about. They have to have an incredibly high and cross discipline, knowledge of science, and they have to have a lot of physical conditioning. So the astronaut, that's what they call it, the right stuff. You've got to have the right stuff to be an astronaut. And very much Matt Damon's Mark Watney shows that that's the case in this movie. And indeed, as do the other astronauts. Yeah, they kind of make some decisions that are going to change the course of their life during the arc of the movie. But they do it making their decisions logically. The decisions are made not always for emotional reasons, but because the job requires those decisions to be made in a certain way. And I kind of like that and I respect that. There's no evocation of deity in this movie. And for somebody who is as secular as me, it's kind of refreshing. I see some movies that are supposedly science-based, and there have been a number of them, where they shoehorn religion into the science. And it's kind of the way it is with Contact, that Jodie Foster film with Matthew McConaughey in it. And it is with Interstellar to a certain extent as well. I don't think it's a comfortable fit there. Belief is not the same thing as evidence. And praying doesn't achieve anything except changing oxygen to carbon dioxide and making people feel better. There's a kind of placebo effect of prayer that's something I find quite alien, and for me at least, and in my worldview, of no assistance. But getting back to the movie for a moment after that little rant, I just did a bit of research on Wadi Rum in Jordan. It actually means Valley of the Moon, which is kind of cool. It's a protected area in southern Jordan. And there are a number of films that have been filmed there. Let's have a look here. Lawrence of Arabia. David Lean filmed a lot of Lawrence of Arabia in Wadi Rum. Red Planet, of course, from 2000. Transformers Revenge of the Fallen. Well, we can leave that one aside. Prometheus. Kurishri, which is the fourth sequel to Koi Mil Gaya, an Indian superhero science fiction movie. Last Days on Mars, and of course The Martian. If you look at the Wikipedia page, there are some fantastic pictures of Wadi Rum, which makes me want to go there, I'll tell you. But the movie The Martian I like because I like a good adventure film. I like a good kind of survival movie. Grew up with movies like Sands of the Kalahari, for instance, and Flight of the Phoenix, and all of those ones where people in adverse and desert circumstances usually basically think their way out of a problem. And I really do like that kind of film. And this movie is very much in that genre of survival stories, but on a much bigger scale and with much bigger distances to cover, of course. And I want to see more of this kind of stuff. I think that there's room for this kind of science fiction. I think that now that the technology is there and the audience want this kind of film, I think in the future we're going to see more solid, hard science fiction movies come out. Some are going to be good, some are going to be bad, some are going to be mediocre. But we're going to get more of it. With the success of this film, it can only lead to good things for other science fiction movies if the studios have any sense. I think people want stories where people succeed. They want stories where people work hard and show results for it, because very often in the way the world is geared, that doesn't happen. People work very hard and to very little result. And having an inspirational story where that's not happening and where the opposite happens, I think plays to our aspirations as human beings. And even though it may be slightly fictional in the sense that working hard doesn't always get you success, I think that it's better than pessimism, it's better than nihilism, it's better than giving up and knowing that the odds are stacked against you and not doing anything about them. I think one of the things that human beings do is they get up the next morning and do things. And even though that's very hard for some of us, and I'm fully aware of that, I was thinking about that when I was watching the movie as well. It must have been hard at various times for the character of Mark Watney to get up in the morning and just do things. He didn't get weekends. He didn't get downtime. Every day was a solid workload of survival-oriented effort and survival-oriented thinking and survival-oriented improvising. And I think that's kind of cool. I really like that sort of film. Sciencing the shit out of a problem should be the mantra for the rest of the 21st century, as far as I'm concerned, because I think that properly applied and applied with lack of selfishness and with an eye to improving the world, sciencing the shit out of the planet is the way we're going to survive. But anyway, that's about it for The Martian versus Robinson Crusoe on Mars. I think they're both fine films of their time. I think that particularly The Martian speaks to the aspirations we have in a changing and chaotic and at times scary world. The idea of somebody in much worse circumstances than ourselves surviving and thriving is kind of a story that people like hearing it. In some respects, I suppose, a story that we need to hear. And that kind of works. It's kind of a feel-good story, but not soft. It's a kind of rational feel-good story. And I like it for that. But anyway, that's about it for this time around. This podcast is a bit short because my throat is giving out. I've done two podcasts in one day. And for some reason, that seems to stress the vocal cords and the throat, as you can probably hear. Anyway, look after yourselves. Be nice to each other. Enjoy good movies. Enjoy bad movies. Keep watching the skies. I'm going to be back next week with another Paleo Cinema podcast. And in 2 weeks, with another Martian Drive-In podcast. Check out the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. And if you need any recommendations for other podcasts to listen to, I'm more than happy to provide them through social media. Things like The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema and Silver and Gold. I love that album. And all of the other B-Movie podcast, amongst other things. There are just so many good movie-related podcasts out there now. I'm surprised you're listening to this one. But anyway, take care. I'm off to Sydney in a day and a half. And I'll obviously be updating social media while I'm there. So take care and I'll catch you guys later. And of course, here, as always, are the credits in the style of movie credits. I'll catch you later. And now here are the podcast credits. I'd like to thank Tom, our focus puller, Sarah, our special effects technician, Ian, the caterer, Grant, our Technicolor consultant, Claire, the script doctor, Gary, the prop master, Morris, our musical director, Jan, our dialect coach, Armin, our key grip, Matt, our rattlesnake wrangler, Elaine, our scientific advisor, Julia, our casting director, Chris, our camera operator, Christopher, our gaffer, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Tansy, our foley artist, Alyssa, our location scout, Mark, our second unit director, Paul, our special makeup effects director, Tamora, the donut wrangler, Tim, the New York unit director, Rabbi Steve, our spiritual advisor, Steve Solomon, our werewolf consultant, Dylan, the goat wrangler, Eric, our set security lead, Richard H., our set photographer, and the two extras, Mark D. and David L. Thank you to all of the podcast supporters.